God is a God of order. Now, some, unfortunately, equate order with boredom, lifelessness. Not so. Order is constructive. Order preserves and enhances life. Don't you wish the rioters and anarchists in Seattle and Portland and St. Louis and New York City understood that? Order preserves and enhances life. Could you play tennis without the lines? Would you be safe on the highways without guardrails? I don't think so. Now, the boundaries that we create can be divisive. But when God puts up a boundary, it is always constructive. It always contributes to our well-being. As we return to Genesis chapter 1, let me just review for a moment. We see in Genesis 1, verses 3 through 25, a beautiful symmetry taking shape, an order, a design, a purposefulness, if you will. There is a purposefulness, an order, a symmetry in the way in which God dealt with the darkness, the formlessness, the emptiness of the primeval earth that's described in verse 2. On day 1, God created light, not to do away with darkness, but to relieve it, to regulate it, to put limits on it, to provide something to alternate with it. Day and night came into existence. On day 2, he separated the celestial waters from the terrestrial waters by creating the expanse we know as heaven or sky. It's that canopy up there. And that separation, that division, brought a degree of form to what had been formless. And this expanse we call heaven or sky, God will fill. He will populate with birds on day 5. Thus, addressing in part the emptiness described in verse 2. So we have formlessness giving way to form, emptiness giving way to a population, abundance. On day 3, that which had been formless, that which had been disorganized, continues to take on shape as God gathers together the terrestrial waters to form seas and causes dry land to appear. He's going to address the emptiness of the earth further by creating vegetation, which will also feed the animals and the 2 human beings he will make on days 5 and 6. Now, at this point, I need to say a word about the Hebrew term yom. It's translated day in Genesis chapter 1. It can mean, the word yom, translated day, can mean a solar 24-hour period. Or it can mean a period an extended period of undetermined length, as in the day of the Lord. There are three compelling reasons, I find them compelling, for understanding Yom in Genesis 1 in terms of a solar day, a 24-hour period, rather than an age or an extended period of undetermined length. Reason number one, each of the 6 days of creation comprises an evening and a morning. Evening and morning cannot be construed to mean age, but only day. Reason number two, everywhere else in the Old Testament where the word, this word Yom appears with an ordinal number, it refers to a solar day, a 24-hour day. The ordinal numbers are 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and so on. The cardinal numbers are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So where outside of Genesis 1 in the Old Testament, wherever Yom appears with an ordinal number, first day, second day, third day, it refers to a 24-hour period. Third reason. A normal understanding of the fourth commandment in Exodus 20:11 suggests a 24-hour day. We read in Exodus 20:11, in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and the earth and rested on the seventh. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. The Sabbath age? No. The Sabbath day. The word translated days or day in Exodus 20:11 is this same word yom that we have in Genesis 1. Why does this matter? It matters because those who believe that God used evolutionary processes to create the universe, that view is called theistic evolution. Those who believe God used evolutionary processes to create need lots and lots of time. In fact, they need billions of years. The formula for evolution is as follows. Random mutations plus natural selection plus time equals evolution. Again, random mutations plus natural selection plus time equals evolution. Given enough time, the evolutionists claim, anything is possible. Have you heard that? Given enough time, anything is possible. No. Some things are inherently impossible. They are never going to happen. It's not in the cards. Regardless of how much time one allows. As the old proverb says, you are never going to get a silk purse out of a sow's ear. Not in a year. Not in 1,000 years, not in 1,000,000 years, not in 100,000,000 years. You're never going to get a silk purse out of a sow's ear. And life will never arise from non-life. Oswald Alice, whom I introduced to you last Sunday, wrote, to evolve water into wine could not be done any more successfully in 1,000,000 years than in a day. It's just not in the cards. It's not happening. But Jesus did it instantaneously. Limitless time, Oswald continued, is a poor substitute for an omnipotent God. The reason the biblical, I'm still quoting Alice, the reason the biblical account of creation is so impressive is it speaks in terms of the creative acts of an omnipotent God, not in terms of infinite time and endless process. I want us to note, back in Genesis 1, that as soon as the first living things appear on planet Earth, plants, we read of reproduction according to kind. God said, verse 11, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. Each according to its kind. We looked at one of the elements of that equation for evolution time. Now let's look at another, random mutations. Random mutations. I'm sorry if this sounds like a biology lecture, but these are critical issues. Random mutations alter existing structures. They do not lead to the creation of new structures. As many experiments with fruit flies demonstrate. Since Drosophila, that's the fruit fly, can reproduce after only 5 days, it's possible for researchers to observe the effects of mutations over many generations. Back in 2006, Frank Sherwin of the Institute for Creation Research wrote, since 1910, geneticists have documented over 3,000 mutations among fruit flies. But scientific journals have not recorded a single fruit fly evolving into something else. In one case, a mutation did produce a fruit fly with four wings. And you might guess that such a super fly would have an advantage over his neighbors. More wings, faster flight, get to the food quicker. No, the ability that flies, the ability of the four-winged fly to fly was severely impaired. I'll tell you why a little later. But for now, put this down. All mutations can do is reshuffle the genetic deck. They can't introduce new cards. Mutations can only shuffle what's already there. On day 4, now we're looking at verses 14 and following. On day 4, God creates the sun, the moon, and the stars. Their brightness differs, doesn't it? Some stars are very bright, some less bright. They exhibit diversity, variety, which God loves. And thus, with the creation of sun, moon, and stars, a further layer of form, structure, emerges. We now have days and years. We have appointed times. We have seasons. We have sequence. Summer follows winter. Day follows night. On day 5, God creates marine animals to populate the seas. One of the environments he prepared on day 3. And also birds on day 5, to fly across the environment he created on day two, the sky, the heavens. And on day six, God creates livestock, creeping things, beasts, to fill the other environment he prepared on the third day, land. All of this, as I say, God carefully orchestrated. Nothing happened by chance. There's no randomness to it. No breakouts. No crossing of boundaries. The creatures God put in the sea stayed in the sea. The creatures he put in the sky stayed there. The creatures he put on land stayed there. Evolution, of course, envisions fish becoming amphibians. Amphibians becoming reptiles, reptiles becoming mammals. But there's a problem with that. Luther Burbank, perhaps the greatest plant breeder and horticulturalist of all time, found that the tendency for organisms to stay true to type is, quote, so constant that it can be considered a natural law. Burbank called that law the law of the reversion to the average. He explained that principle in these terms. The law of the reversion to the average, keeps all living things within some more or less fixed limitations. He's confirming Genesis chapter 1, reproduction after its kind. Let's dig a little deeper into this. You got to use your imagination here. Suppose a fish were to evolve lungs. Would those lungs enable it to move up to the next evolutionary stage? No. It would drown. If a fish with that had evolved lungs stayed in the water, it would drown. Living things cannot change piecemeal. Put that down. Living things cannot change piecemeal. An organism is an integrated system. Any isolated change in the system, so that's what mutation is more likely to harm the organism than to help it. If a fish's gills started to mutate into a set of lungs, it would be a disaster. To emerge on land, that fish would have to transform all at once with not only lungs, but changes in its skeletal system, in its circulatory system, etc. The term for this is irreducible complexity. Simply stated, irreducible complexity says an organism cannot evolve in gradual steps. The guy who developed the concept of irreducible complexity, Michael Behe, was a professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University. He used the illustration, this is helpful, I think. He used the illustration of a mouse trap. A mouse trap cannot be assembled gradually. You can't start with a wooden platform and catch a few mice, then add a spring and catch a few more mice, and add a hammer and catch a few more. No. It's all got to be there, all properly assembled and integrated to even start catching mice. All the parts have to be present and properly integrated and assembled. Many organisms in the natural world are like a mousetrap. If one part were to evolve in isolation from the other parts, the whole system would shut down. It would stop functioning. And then the process of natural selection would take over and see to it that that non-functioning organism was eliminated. Like a fish with lungs. Significantly, Charles Darwin himself admitted, quote, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organism existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down." It's Darwin himself. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organism existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. I've got news for Mr. Darwin. Nature abounds with such complex organisms that could not have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications. Here's another example. Evolutionists suggest that the bat, we had one in our bedroom the other day. I'm glad there's no video. Pastor Deibler could be seen swinging a fishing net around. So I finally stunned the critter and took him outside and let him go. Or maybe I ended his life. Anyway, evolutionists suggest that the bat evolved from some mouse-like creature whose forelimbs developed by a series of slight, numerous, successive modifications into wings. Right? Given enough time, anything's possible, right? No. So today's bat evolved from a mouse-like creature, says the evolutionist, whose forelimbs developed by a series of numerous slight successive modifications into wings. Try to visualize that. It's comical. As those front toes of that mouse-like creature grow longer and skin begins to grow between them, the animal can no longer run without stumbling over its forelimbs. Yet those forelimbs are not yet long enough to function as wings. So during most of its so-called transitional stages, that poor mouse-like creature that's evolving into a bat can't do one thing or the other. It can't run. It can't fly. It can only flop around helplessly and eventually become extinct. In the fossil record, there are no fossils leading up to bats. The first time bats appear in the fossil record, they're already fully formed and virtually identical to modern bats, which is exactly what we would expect given the principle of irreducible complexity. complex organisms cannot change. They cannot evolve piecemeal. Let me tell you why that four-winged Drosophila fruit fly was less able to, was why its ability to fly was severely impaired. It didn't develop a corresponding or an accompanying set of muscles. It had four wings, but only one set of muscles to operate the wings. Wings three and four had no accompanying muscles. There's no record, there's no evidence for macroevolution. That is, one species turning into another species. Macroevolution. There's a lot of evidence for microevolution. See it, we see it around us all the time. We can't deny that. You know, Darwin's famous finches. You remember that? Remember those? The beaks, you know, the differences in beaks. That's microevolution. That's change within a kind, within a species. There's no evidence for macroevolution. Again, the first time bats appear in the fossil record, they're fully formed, virtually identical to modern bats. So if there's no evidence for macroevolution, why does the scientific establishment cling to it so fiercely? Because it provides a way to legitimately underpin, prop up the worldview of naturalism. Evolution allows one to factor God out of the equation. The real conflict, as Chuck Colson and Nancy Percy explain in their magnificent book, How Now Shall We Live? The real conflict is not between the Bible and science. Rather, it is between two diametrically opposed worldviews, naturalism and theism. Is the universe governed by blind material forces? Naturalism. Or by an intelligent, loving, personal, supreme being, theism. One evolutionist admitted very openly that the real conflict is not between the Bible and science, but between naturalism and theism. His name is William Provine. He was on the faculty of Cornell University. Provine acknowledged very frankly that Darwinism is not just about mutations and fossils. It is, quote, a comprehensive philosophy which insists that all life can be explained in terms of natural causes acting randomly, which implies no need for a creator. There's the bottom line. And if God did not create the world, Provine concludes correctly, then the entire Christian faith collapses. But make no mistake, despite the fact that Darwinism is fatally flawed, its reach is extensive. You know that? It's everywhere. The influence of Darwinism is felt far beyond the biology or chemistry lab. John Dewey, for example, who largely shaped modern secular education in America, was a Darwinian. John Dewey, he was a Darwinian. Dewey reasoned that if humans are just biological mechanisms, then our mind is simply an organ that has evolved from lower forms in the struggle for existence, like wings or claws. Our mind is valuable, according to Dewey, only insofar as it gives the organism an edge, a better chance at survival. Ideas, then, are not insights into objective reality to be judged by whether they're true or false. Ideas are merely provisional guesses as to what will bring about some desired result. And they are to be judged by whether or not they work. Not by whether or not they're true or false, but whether or not they work. That's pragmatism, by the way. So what's the practical effect of this kind of thinking? Where does it lead? Well, we have political operatives slandering their candidate's opponent, hollering, he paid no taxes. When questioned about the morality of, and he did pay taxes. When they're questioned about the morality of that strategy, they reply, he didn't get elected, right? It worked. The slander worked. Never mind whether it was true or false. It worked. It brought about the desired result. Therefore, it's acceptable. It's true. So the end justifies the means. This is very timely. If violence, how many people think, how many rioters, anarchists think like this? If violence advances the cause of social justice, then it's acceptable because the end justifies the means. And ideas are not insights into objective reality to be judged by whether or not they're true or false. They're just provisional guesses about which course of action is going to produce the desired result. We're almost through. In peddling his gospel of Darwinism on college campuses, William Provine used the following overhead to emphasize what evolution means, where it leads. What's the end of the line? If it's applied consistently, if it's applied in a thoroughgoing manner, here's where evolution leads, according to Provine. Quote, no life after death, no ultimate foundation for ethics. That's scary. No ultimate meaning for life. That's scary too. But by the way, that's called nihilism. No free will. End quote. No wonder Satan attacks the biblical account of creation. There's so much at stake. No wonder he attacks the biblical account of creation and puts in its place the theory of evolution. I think Provine was right. Creation is the foundation, in some respects, it is the foundation of Christianity. If Genesis is a myth, then the cross becomes unnecessary, irrelevant. See, evolution factors out God. If there's no God, there's no law. If there's no law, there can be no law breaking. There's no law breaking, there's no sin. And if there's no sin, we don't need a savior. We don't need the cross. That's what Satan's up to. Satan desperately wants to keep people away from the cross because that's where his head was crushed. That's where his power was broken. That's where he was disarmed and unmasked. We must stand for the doctrine of creation, and we must preach the cross. God, help us to do it for Jesus' sake. Amen.